This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. All of us are time travelers. We go back in history to turning points in our lives and imagine how things could have turned out differently. What would have happened if we had chosen different paths, swiped right instead of left, moved abroad, or quit smoking? This week on Hidden Brain, we look at the choices we wish we'd made and the ones we wish we hadn't. We'll tell you a story that shows when our minds reach for these alternate realities.
I'm responsible because I didn't listen to him and what he was saying.
And we'll also look at other scenarios where we're less likely to ask, what if? Laura Ogden has spent years imagining how things could have turned out differently. At the very start is a pair of skis. She and her friends would go out to the mountains in Washington State.
Going as fast as we can and going as steep as we can, starting to jump off rocks and challenge ourselves with our fear. I think that became something I was drawn to and I guess addicted to as time went on.
When she got to college,
the whole ski culture opened up to me, so it snowballed, no pun intended, from there.
She moved from skiing resorts to wild slopes where it was just her, some friends, and the elements. They'd hauled themselves to the top of mountains with skis on their backs, no ski lifts, no ski patrol, no cozy lodge with hot chocolate. Laura began to enter skiing competitions. She met a professional skier named Jack Hannon. Laura says skiing with someone can lead to a deep connection.
It's like a landscape that can really conjure up a magic to it, awe-inspiring scenery. You get up into these mountains, and to be sharing that with somebody, it just hits you deeply, and then sometimes it can be quite arduous, like getting up to the top of a big peak. So you go through that suffering together, for lack of a better word, and then get this massive reward of skiing. It is almost like out of body experience in a way, like this smooth ease of flow going down, and you know that person is having their own yet similar experience to you, and they can understand that, and that having that shared excitement together, I mean, the rest is history.
Laura and Jack got married in 2008. They bought a house on a big swath of land in the remote mountains of Canada. They planned to be homesteaders, and of course, they would ski. Life was good.
Going from day to day and not having too much to worry about besides where you're going to go skiing and are you going to have spaghetti for dinner or burritos, because simple life.
One day in March 2010, their friends Dave and Tessa Treadway invited them to go skiing on Mount Currie. Dave and Tessa were also professional skiers. Dave had been out that week and found that conditions were good. So Laura and Jack said yes. The friends loaded their gear onto a helicopter that would drop them off at the top of the mountain. The pilot flew them to the top of Mount Currie. They'd gotten a late start. Instead of the usual 6 or 7 a.m., they made it to the top of the mountain around 11. The four friends tested the conditions by pushing a giant block of snow down the mountain.
You're basically creating an avalanche ahead of you. So once you get on the snow to ski, it's much less likely that any avalanche underneath is going to happen again, because all that snow underneath you is consolidated.
One by one, the friends began skiing.
Tessa and I were together, and then Jack had skied down to us, and then we were waiting for Dave to come down. we were kind of feeling like we were at the end of the more intense part, and we're feeling pretty good, and we're feeling like now it was time to go home, basically. I know it was about 2:30 in the afternoon, and I was kind of on the top of this shoulder, and I heard Dave yelling, "Avalanche!" One thing I think is hard to imagine is just how heavy and forceful a whole bunch of snow can actually be. When it's coming down at 60 miles an hour, it's like a freight train. I just stood there, frozen. I didn't have anywhere safe that I could hunker down, like a rock or a tree to kind of hide behind. So I knew that there was nothing that I could do.
Laura was not in the direct path of the avalanche. When it passed, she was still standing. There were clouds of fog around her.
And I yelled, "Jack," and didn't hear anything. And then I yelled, "Tessa," and she yelled back.
Dave called out that he was okay. But Jack? Laura and her friends took out their avalanche beacons. They knew that Jack's beacon would be broadcasting his location. If they picked up his signal, their devices would ping. Avalanche beacons are designed to ping faster if rescuers get closer to a missing skier. They're like metal detectors. Laura stared down the path of the avalanche. She and Dave took off down the mountain to find Jack, leaving Tessa as a lookout.
The avalanche was so big that it had taken most of the snowpack away, and suddenly we were forced to ski down this terrain that was gnarly. Like, all right, I'm going to hop over this rock and I'm going to slide down this ice. Crazy how it was inconsequential, like it wasn't a big deal for me. I was way more focused on, we gotta go get Jack, so let's do what needs to be done. The avalanche beacon was telling me that I was basically a meter away from Jack's avalanche transceiver.
But when she got to the spot, she could see nothing besides snow and ice and debris. She dropped to her knees. She got out her shovel and started to dig.
The snow was so frozen and packed together that I couldn't really move the snow that way, so I had my ice axe.
She hacked away at the snowpack.
And I quickly discovered Jack's, the jacket he was wearing, his shoulder. So he wasn't very deep under the snow, and I found him.
She used her hands to claw away the snow. She needed to get to his face, to get him air.
When I dug enough around his upper body and face, it started to dawn on me that he wasn't alive.
What do you do in the minutes after you come to such a realization?
What had just happened was not hitting me at all. I remember Tessa trying to talk to me. I was still on this version of autopilot.
There was work to be done. They dug out a flat platform for a rescue helicopter to land. When they made it back down the mountain, Laura gave a statement to a police officer.
I remember sitting in this little room with the RCMP officer and giving him details of what had happened, kind of like deadpan in a way, just stating the facts. And somehow I was able to describe to him how my husband had just been killed by an avalanche.
She kept it together until her best friend arrived.
That's just when I lost it. I think I finally knew, or I don't really know. I had let it all go.
But right as she started to break down, a voice in the back of her head reminded her of something that Jack had said that morning before they'd boarded the helicopter. They'd been sitting in their truck.
And Jack and I were by ourselves and looking at Mount Currie, and Jack said to me, "You know, I have a bad feeling about today."
This was unusual. Jack was not a worrier. And when he didn't feel safe, he wasn't ambivalent.
Jack's definitely been the one to say, "I'm not into going out. I'm going to pull the plug." And he's adamant.
Laura asked him,
"Well, if you have a bad feeling, do you think we should not go?" And I don't think he wanted to be the one to say, "No, let's not go."
What did he say in response to you?
He was slow to respond, I remember, and said, "Well, no, we can still go."
Laura couldn't bear to tell her friend about it.
I felt really guilty. And, you know, I even have a little bit of shamefulness now admitting it, that I'm responsible because I didn't listen to him and what he was saying. You know, it almost adds to the tragedy of it. Like, Jack had this feeling and we went anyway.
Over and over, she replayed what had happened and imagined how things could have turned out differently. Laura's regret and pain are completely understandable. Her reaction also reveals something important about how the mind works, how we process the past, and how we think about the future. You're listening to Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. From C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. When we think back on our lives, our minds tend to focus on specific events. We might imagine how things could have unfolded differently. We don't realize it, but there are psychological triggers that bring about these fantasies.
Jack said to me,
years after Jack died, Laura still thinks about that day on Mount Currie. It's a video that plays on endless loop in her mind. She keeps rewinding, pressing play.
I have a bad feeling about today.
And then her mind changes the narrative so Jack doesn't die. There's a technical name for this type of alternate reality, a counterfactual. Kathleen Vo studies how and why our minds produce these fantasies. She's a psychologist at the University of Minnesota.
A counterfactual is a mental simulation where you think about what did happen, so some event led to another event.
And then you think of an alternate ending.
For example, if you drive home from work today and you get into a car accident, that would be terrible, and you may start thinking about why that happened. If you took a new route home from work, one of the counterfactuals may be, now if only I had stuck to my usual way of going home, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
Laura's counterfactual looks like this. She and Jack sit in their truck looking up at Mount Currie. Jack says,
"You know, I have a bad feeling about today."
And Laura says,
"Well, then I think we should listen to your bad feeling and trust that intuition and not go."
Jack lives. Laura's world remains intact. The reason Laura comes up with this alternate ending is because she wants it to be true. At the same time, she knows these thoughts aren't very useful. She can't bring her husband back. So why does her mind keep producing these thoughts? It turns out there are specific elements to the story that invite counterfactual thinking. To understand what they are, meet Neil Rose.
I'm a professor of marketing at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
Neil has found four triggers for counterfactual thinking. One, a clearly bad outcome.
When I dug enough around his upper body and face, it started to dawn on me that he wasn't alive.
Just seeing something negative or something that falls short of expectations, that tends to bring counterfactuals to mind.
Two, something happened that was out of the ordinary.
I'd never heard Jack say this before, that he was like, you know, I have a bad feeling about today.
The husband saying that he has a bad feeling about it, presumably that's a rare occurrence, but it was significant on that moment. It becomes more significant after the fact, of course, but it's unusual. And so our thoughts very naturally gravitate toward that unusual aspect.
Three, you can see how you yourself or some other person played a central role in what happened.
I'm responsible because I didn't listen to him and what he was saying.
Four, you can draw a direct connection between what someone did or didn't do and the negative thing that happened. Cause and effect are close together.
We look at actions that are relatively close to a key outcome. In other words, maybe a few minutes before or even a few hours before, but not years in the past.
So Laura doesn't rewind the tape so far back that she questions why she became a skier. As Kathleen Vos points out, she rewinds the story to the conversation in the truck.
There is a moment where they discuss doing something different. The counterfactual is just so salient for her story. And she, along with Jack, made a different decision. And then here we are.
Counterfactuals don't exist just to drive us crazy. We engage in this kind of thinking for a reason.
Counterfactual thoughts are generally useful for us in terms of providing a set of options that we might act upon in the future. And this can lead to improvement. It can lead to learning from experience.
When we go back and revisit a decision that turned out poorly, when we imagine how we could have made a different decision, it can be painful. But it can also be very useful. It can help us see how, if the same kind of situation rolls around again, we could do something different next time. There's a second reason counterfactuals are psychologically useful.
When something bad happens, kind of shakes your confidence that you understand the world and you can predict what's going to happen. And so when people engage in counterfactuals and they simulate other alternate pathways, that this, if I had done this differently, then this negative thing may not have occurred, gives them some sense of control that they kind of understand the world more. And that can help, in a psychological sense, be a very adaptive pattern.
This is all healthy. We turn bad things that happened into lessons for the future. And by imagining how we could have changed what happened, we get a feeling of control and agency. Counterfactuals become a driver of change, of action. Of course, this leads to the question, what happens when events do not set off counterfactual thinking? As Neil shows, there are specific features in a story that cause our minds to come up with alternate versions. Without those triggers, we don't engage in counterfactuals. And without counterfactuals, we're often not inclined to change our behavior. This relationship between counterfactuals and behavior made me think about a conversation I had a few years back, and it brings us to a second scenario we want to explore today. I was visiting the Mendenhall Glacier in Alaska. We did an episode about it some time ago. The glacier is a dazzling sight, but it's also a bleak lesson in climate change. It's receded dramatically in a matter of decades. As I was standing at a viewing point, Terry Lambert, visiting from Southern California, came up beside me. We both stared at the wall of ice in the distance. I introduced myself.
I'm wondering if I might talk with you for a moment. I'm a journalist. I work for NPR in Washington.
And asked him what he made of the glacier's retreat.
The glaciers, a lot of it gets replaced every year when it snows. It might be receding in, but we're still going to have snow. We're still going to get some replaced. So I just think it's, I mean, as old as they are, they can't last forever. yeah, it's receding faster, but what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? I thought back to that conversation with Terry in the context of Laura's story. Unlike Laura, Terry wasn't bothered by counterfactual thoughts. He didn't say, if only humans hadn't burned so much fossil fuel, maybe the glacier wouldn't have receded. He didn't say, what could I have done to head off climate change? Surveys have found that about half of all Americans don't worry that much about a warming planet. Psychologists Neil Rose and Kathleen Vose think that our responses to challenges like climate change might be very different from our responses to a skiing accident because climate change doesn't have the four triggers that set off counterfactual thinking. Take what Terry told me, for instance. He didn't see what was happening to the glacier as something negative.
Even if it all melts, it's not going to be the end of the world.
There could be changes. Some species could be advantaged, some species could be disadvantaged. The ecosystem is changing. You're going to have flooding. You could have weather events, right? There could be consequences that affect you and I.
Yes. But like I say, it's so far in the future, I'm not worried about it.
Two, counterfactuals are triggered when you can see something happen that's out of the ordinary. Terry doesn't see anything unusual about the receding glacier.
You know, everything goes around in circles, I guess, so... You know, it starts at one place and goes back to the beginning and at some point. So, not in my lifetime, but I'm sure at some point we'll probably have another ice age.
Three, counterfactuals spring to mind when you can see how you yourself or some other person played a central role in what happened. In Terry's case?
I personally don't think it's something that man's doing that's making that melt.
And four, seeing a direct connection between an outcome and what someone did or didn't do tends to produce counterfactuals. Cause and effect need to be side by side. In the case of climate change, the causes are diffuse and distant, and the worst effects have not yet happened. Obviously, even if you accept the reality of climate change, you can't lay the responsibility for it at the feet of any one person.
The key difference between these two different stories is the immediacy of the negative outcome. It's something either very abrupt and very, very severe that happens to you at a particular moment versus something that unfolds more generally, more slowly, and is not that much of a direct impact on your life. And so the difference between these two is that the first one will activate a lot of counterfactual thoughts focusing on your own action. The second one is just more diffuse and perhaps is going to be involved with a bit more fatalism, just feeling like, well, this is the way things are, and there's not much I can do.
If counterfactual thinking tends to lead us to act, an absence of counterfactual thinking can keep us from seeing what we can do.
Well, it's just like earthquakes and floods and hurricanes. They're just all part of what's going on. You can't control it. You can't change it.
The retreat of the Mendenhall Glacier is not in itself proof of climate change. But when scientists zoom out and look at all the data, their consensus is that climate change is happening and that its consequences are all around us. Human actions are tied to the problems that have already struck. Human inaction is directly implicated in the disasters that are to come. Kathleen Vose says, from a psychological perspective, the difficulty in coming up with counterfactuals for climate change can easily produce apathy.
We don't really know what kind of a role each and every one of us plays in all of that. And so it makes her just psychologically a very kind of messy understanding of who's responsible, what should we do, and it's very hard to understand the results or even know when they may come about. They may not even come about in our lifetimes, which makes it even more psychologically remote.
In Laura's case, she can see the one specific thing she could have done to prevent Jack's death. But
it's very hard to see a cause and effect relationship to, throwing another soda can in the recycling bin and seeing the temperature of the oceans not rise nearly as fast.
Not all environmental problems are like climate change. Some do trigger counterfactual thinking, and these lead us to act. Terry Lambert wasn't worried about climate change, but when there was an environmental problem close to home, one that was wiping out a species of mollusks, he literally came to the rescue. He used to dive off the Anacapa Islands in California.
They were having a problem with the black abalone being extinct and some of it, and I did several dives and helped replace the abalone. We built habitats for them and put them in there. So the local environment, yeah, I've had my hands on it. And, you know, you do what you can do.
You do what you can do. That's pretty much the opposite of what he said about the shrinking glacier.
Yeah, it's receding faster, but yeah. What are you going to do?
It's telling that Terry felt compelled to do something about the local issue. He could see his role in the solution. This might be a hint at a way around the kinks in our counterfactual thinking. If unconscious rules keep us from thinking about counterfactuals when they could be useful, we might have to consciously choose to open the door to these thoughts.
I think it's just a simple conversational style where you could just directly ask, what could you personally have done differently? How could you have made things better? How could you have performed a more positive action? And so I think it is a reasonable thing to bring up in a conversation.
Other times, we may need to talk ourselves out of engaging in counterfactuals.
For Laura, it does make a great deal of sense that she's doing that, although, of course, there's really no way that she has culpability or responsibility here.
My journey definitely continues. I definitely was taking less risk and skiing much more conservatively, but I still had such powerful connections with the mountains because that's where I connected with Jack.
Like every useful feature in the brain, counterfactuals don't always spring to mind when they're needed. Sometimes they show up when they're not useful, and they produce unnecessary pain. Other times, they fail to appear, fostering apathy. Sometimes, the path you wish you'd pursued is just a mirage. Other times, there was a turn you needed to take. All you had to do was see it. When we time travel in our heads, we don't just fixate on decisions in the past. We think about how the decisions we make will affect our future selves.
The best way to predict your future is not to close your eyes and use your imagination. There is a completely different way to figure out how you will feel.
That's coming up after the break. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fifth Generation Incorporated, maker of Tito's Handmade Vodka, offering one flavor, vodka-flavored vodka. 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka is distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas. From Duolingo, a language app whose mission is to make language learning fun and accessible to the world, with lessons in more than 30 languages, including French, Spanish, and Chinese. Available in the App Store, or at Duolingo.com. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Many scientists who study people end up saying some version of the following sentence. The human being is the only animal that
has a sense of humor.
That do radio shows.
That regularly fashion and use tools.
That have chins.
Psychologist Daniel Gilbert at Harvard University finishes the sentence this way. The human being is the only animal that thinks about the future.
Every animal learns from trial and error. Human beings learn from experiences they've never even had. They close their eyes and say, would I like liver and onion ice cream? Yuck. Would it be a good idea to put my finger in a pencil sharpener? No.
But just because we humans have great imaginations, it doesn't mean we do a good job of predicting the future accurately.
People just aren't very good at looking into their future and predicting correctly their emotional reactions to the events that might unfold.
We think a dentist appointment will be awful, and then it's not so bad. We think buying a new car will make us very happy, but it ends up being just nice. We think losing a job is the worst thing that could happen to us, and then it becomes the best thing. The problem is, once our minds get to work imagining the future, we leave out important details, like the nice lady at the front desk in the dentist office, or the free toothbrush. When I think about the future, I also don't consider the fact that I'm going to be a different person in the future, someone who may want a minivan instead of a convertible. most of us also underestimate how good we are at rationalizing the decisions that we make. Joining me today to talk about our foggy foresight and what we can do to make it better is psychologist Daniel Gilbert. He's the author of the book Stumbling on Happiness and one of my favorite researchers in the world. Dan, welcome to Hidden Brain.
Well, thank you. You're now my favorite radio host in the world.
Well, that was easy. I want to start by asking you a question that you and I talked about a while ago, Dan. Some years ago, you went through a series of very difficult personal experiences, but instead of leaving you brokenhearted, as you might have anticipated, it left you with actually a very important insight into your own ability to predict your future emotional states. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, you know, my personal experiences were no worse than the average person's, in fact, better than most. But, you know, like everybody, I suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You know, we have divorces, we have surgeries, we have breakups with women we love and friends we enjoy. So it was sort of ordinary events that befell me all in one year. And I realized that had you asked me a year earlier how I would be faring, the answer would have been, oh my gosh, I'll be devastated. But I wasn't devastated. It wasn't a good year, but it was okay. And it made me wonder if I was the only person who was just too stupid to be able to look ahead into his future and figure out how he'd feel if really bad or maybe really good things happened. So I went to the laboratory and teamed up with my friend Tim Wilson, and we started studying this phenomenon. And, you know, reassuringly, we found out we weren't the only stupid people out there.
You've also found that painful decisions are often painful, largely because we haven't made them yet. Once we actually make a decision, pick one of two alternatives, we often end up wondering how we could ever have dreamed of choosing the other choice.
Well, surely that's true for all of us. We agonize between two things that seem awfully close. We finally choose one, and in a small or medium amount of time, we look back and wonder how we could ever have been trying to decide between them. Why did we make that mistake of thinking the two alternatives were so close when in fact they were really far apart? The answer is they weren't really close and they weren't really far apart. It's just a matter of how you look at it. And when you're on the front side of a decision, alternatives seem to be very close. But once you've chosen one, the mind gets going doing what the mind does so well, convincing you that the thing you've got is better than the thing you've left behind. Now, if psychologists are trying to cure that, we call it rationalization. If we're trying to sell it, we call it coping. But whether you call it coping or rationalization, it's the same thing. It's the mind finding realistic ways to see the world so that it feels better about the world in which it finds itself.
You once subscribed to the very popular belief that I think I still subscribe to, that more freedom always equals more happiness. And if I remember correctly, you conducted a study once that found that this wasn't quite right. And at the time, I think you told me that you'd been living with your girlfriend for more than a decade, and you saw the data and you decided to make some changes in your life.
You have a very good memory. So like many people, I used to believe that the more freedom, the better. How could you be less happy when you had more choice? Well, we know now a lot about why more choice sometimes makes people less happy. In our study, we brought students in and we created a photography course, and we had all of them work with us for a long time learning how to do black and white photography. Then at the end of the course, we gave them two photographs that they had taken, and we said they could keep one and we were going to keep one. Well, this was horrible for them. They wanted to keep both. They had a tough decision to make. In one group, we said, if you ever change your mind about which photograph you want, just let us know. We'll swap with you. We're going to keep this on file forever. So if you took A and you want B, we'll swap B for A for as long as we both shall live. Another group was told, your decision is final. Once you make this decision, the photograph that you're donating to us gets sent off to England. It'll never be seen again.
And of course, if you presented those choices to me, I would say I would want to be in the first group because I would preserve my options. If I took a photograph home and didn't like it, I could come back and trade it in for the one that I did like.
We actually did exactly that in another study. We asked people which group they wanted to be in, and just like you, they overwhelmingly want to be in the first group. But what's interesting is we tracked the happiness of the people who had made these decisions over the course of several weeks. And what we found is that people who made an irrevocable decision, one they couldn't change, were much happier with the choice they made. When you've made an irrevocable decision, you rationalize it. Once something's gone and gone forever, the mind gets to work figuring out why what it got is really better than what it lost. But when a decision isn't irrevocable, when you can remake it and revisit it and change your mind anytime, what do? You just ruminate about it, right? You buy a sweater and you know you can take it back anytime, and every time you put it on, you look in the mirror and you think, I don't know, maybe it's not a good fit, maybe it's not a good color, maybe I ought to bring it back. On the other hand, if this sweater was bought at a place that won't take it back, you look in the mirror and you say, gosh, that looks good.
So you took this research and you applied it to your own life.
I did. I think my then girlfriend and I had been living together for about a decade. And once we saw the results of this experiment, and a friend of mine, Dave Myers, called and said, you know, I think this really explains the difference between living together and getting married, which had never occurred to me. I thought, you know, if you're a scientist and you don't live by your own results, what kind of scientist are you? So I went home and proposed. And guess what? I was utterly right. I love her so much more now that we're married, now that I can't get out of this relationship no matter how fast I run. She is the love of my life. And I didn't realize that when I was always thinking, should I stay or shouldn't I stay?
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for making commitments.
So let's talk a little bit about why these errors often happen. One idea that you've explored is that when we imagine the future, we often fail to take into account all the little details that will actually make us happy or sad.
Well, it's true. Every future event comprises thousands and thousands of details. But when you ask people to imagine a future event, they usually imagine one or two of those details, the ones that are central, that define the episode. So if I say to you, imagine the next visit to the dentist, probably you get a picture in your head instantly of sitting in a chair and someone's fooling around in your mouth. Well, that is indeed a part of the experience you'll have. But you also have to park. You're also going to be in the waiting room. They're going to be playing music. There will be magazines. The receptionist will be nice or not. Afterwards, you will or won't have an appointment you need to rush to. There's lots of other parts of that experience that you're not imagining. And all of them can affect your happiness. Now, you can't imagine every detail. That's not possible. But what you ought to do rationally is think to yourself, I'm only imagining one or two of the many pieces of the experience, and as a result, I should be very humble about my prediction. But nobody is. Instead, they say, a dental visit? I'll hate it.
One of the most interesting things you found in this line of research is that it's not just that we don't imagine the event in the future in all its fullness and detail, but we also don't fully appreciate that we might not quite be the same people we are then that we are now.
You know, I think that's even the more powerful of the two errors. So you're quite right. One problem is that we don't imagine events correctly. That's the smaller of the two problems. The larger problem is that we don't know who we will be when we are experiencing that event. We underestimate the mind's ability to react to events in a different way than it's reacting to them in prospect. You know, things look different from out the windshield and in the rearview mirror. Life is like that, too. Almost every event you experience feels different once you've experienced it than you imagined it would have beforehand. That's the part of our psychology we don't seem very good at anticipating.
Do I recall a study that you did recently which tracked people over the course of their lives and asked them how they imagined they would change in the future versus how they had changed in the past?
You are remembering correctly. We recently published a paper showing that when people are asked to predict how much they will change in the future, they underestimate it. Look, we all know 18-year-olds are crazy. They think they are who they are. They're going to be that way forever. They have crazy hairstyles and tattoos that they believe they're going to want for the rest of their lives. And old people like me snicker and go, you're going to see. Because 18-year-olds underestimate how different they're going to be when they're 28. And we showed this in our experiment by asking 18-year-olds to tell us how much they would change in the next 10 years and asking 28-year-olds to tell us how much they had changed in the last 10 years. In a perfectly rational world, those numbers would be the same, and they weren't. 18-year-olds thought they would change very little. 28-year-olds reported having changed a lot. But what's so interesting about the study is it's also true with 58-year-olds and 68-year-olds. That is, 58-year-olds think, okay, I'm done. I'm cooked. It'll just be me, maybe a little flabbier, more wrinkles, but I'm the guy I'm going to be. 68-year-olds look back to the last 10 years and say, wow, have I changed?
So what's really fascinating about this, Dan, is that no matter how many times we experience these errors in our lives and how many times we make the same mistakes,
somehow we don't learn from them, and we're left with the same confidence that we had before that now, this time, when I predict the future, I'm going to be right.
There are two kinds of errors. Sometimes you're driving someplace and you take the wrong route. The next time, you always get it right. But then there are errors that are more like, oh, optical illusions. You know, you see those two parallel lines on the page and you say, gosh, they don't look parallel to me. And then you measure them and they are, but then you stand back and they don't look that way. So you measure them again, but they are, but they keep not looking that way. I think the kinds of errors we're talking about are a little bit more like optical illusions. You can't help but see the future in this deficient way. Time and time again, you will find your predictions were wrong, and time again, you'll make the same predictions.
I asked Dan to tell me whether he's found ways to help people use their imaginations to make better decisions for their future selves.
We and many others have spent decades trying to figure out how can we make human imagination better? If when people look into the future, they make mistakes, what kind of training could we give them so they don't make these mistakes? And I will give you the summary of 15 years of research. It doesn't work. Almost nothing anybody has ever tried makes a long-lasting, broad difference. On the other hand, the best way to predict your future, we've discovered, is not to close your eyes and use your imagination. There is a completely different way to figure out how you will feel, and that is to ask people who are already in your future how they feel. Almost anything you're imagining. Should I move to Hawaii? Should I become a trumpet player? I wonder if I should subscribe to the New York Times. Would it be better to have a bagel or a bialy? Almost any decision you're debating, large or small, many people have already made it, and they've made it in both directions. There are people who are doing the things you're only imagining. And it turns out that if you can simply measure their happiness, you can get a pretty good guide about how happy you will be in the future. One of the experiments that we did that demonstrated this most simply is we created a speed dating clinic where young women came in and they had a speed date with a young man. And they were offered one of two kinds of information. Either they could learn all about the young man before they met him, they could see his photograph, learn his hobbies, find out about his likes and his dislikes, or they could learn none of that and they could get just one piece of information, namely, how much did the woman who already had a speed date with him enjoy it? Well, it turns out, first of all, everybody wants the first kind of information. The women in our study all think they're going to make a much better prediction of how much they'll enjoy the date if they can just learn about the guy. But what we find is that they're much more accurate in predicting their own experience if they know nothing except another woman's experience. This woman is, in a sense, a surrogate for their future selves, and we call this method surrogation, using other people's experience as a guide to your own.
So there's a commercial application that basically is built on this idea. It's called Yelp.
Exactly right. And there are a few domains in which we all know that we want to rely on other people's reviews, if you will. Movies and restaurants. Those are the two big domains. Now, why are we willing to rely on other people in these domains? Because we can't imagine for ourselves. I mean, if I say, how much do you think you'll enjoy the new restaurant? You look at me and go, how can I possibly close my eyes and imagine that? When we have no information about a future event, we become surrogators. We're willing to listen to other people. But if you offer folks even the smallest piece of information about a future event, they will take that over all the Yelp reviews. So let me ask you, you're going to decide whether to spend a lot of money to buy a movie. Would you rather see the trailer or would you rather read reviews? If you're like most people, you would throw out all the reviews by every critic and every Yelper in the world if you could just see the trailer.
Because you trust your own judgment in some ways better than others.
You feel if you could just taste 30 seconds, 60 seconds of the movie, you'll know if it's the kind of movie you like. But you won't. Other people's reviews are going to be great information about things like, did the movie go on too long? Did the plot get predictable? Did God come out of a machine in the end? All sorts of things you'll never get from a trailer. And yet, if you offer people these two kinds of information, the trailer every time.
So would you suggest that we should actually have Yelp for everything, that we should be rating our friends and spouses and children and professors all, you know, via this kind of distributed review system?
Well, you know, as a professor, I do get rated already, so there is a review system for me. And, you know, at Harvard, we have a quaint tradition. It's called Shopping Week. And in the first week of school, all the students come in and they visit classes. They don't choose their classes ahead of time. They visit them all to see 15 or 20 minutes of a lecture because they're convinced and the administration is convinced that they can tell from 20 minutes of someone's lecture whether they'll really enjoy and get a lot out of the class. What they're ignoring is a huge database of information from people who actually sat through the class for 15 weeks and have a whole lot to say about whether you'll enjoy it or not. You can't convince a student to take a class that has great reviews if they didn't like the 10 minutes of the first lecture. The problem is something we call the illusion of diversity. We think we are utterly unique, that other people's experiences might tell us a little bit about ours, but not very much, because after all, we're so different than everybody. Well, nonsense. You're not different than everybody. We're basically all the same. You know, if a Martian knew everything there was to know, about a single human being on Earth, that Martian would know 90% of what there is to know about everybody on Earth.
I have to push back just a little bit because there's also been, I think, voluminous research conducted by maybe colleagues in the psychology department, which finds that these reviews are also shot through with all kinds of biases. So female professors, for example, get much worse reviews than male professors when they're just as good. I mean, isn't there a risk in essentially outsourcing your judgment to the crowd when the crowd actually is capable fully of having, you know, collective biases?
Well, two things to say about this. First, if you share the biases of the reviewers, they will correctly predict how you will feel, even if it's unfair. So let's say you just don't like old guys like me. Let's say there's a bias. Students can't stand to hear a guy in his 50s yammer and yammer. Well, that's not very fair. That's ageist. That's wrong. On the other hand, when the students say I hated it, it's a pretty good guide for another 18-year-old who will probably hate it for all the same reasons. The second point I'd make is this. I'm not saying that surrogation is a perfect way to make decisions. You know, Winston Churchill once said, democracy is the worst form of government except for the others. Mm-hmm. Well, surrogation is a terrible way to make predictions about your own future happiness, except for the other way to make predictions. You know, imagination is so utterly flawed that surrogation, even with all of its problems, turns out to be a better method than that. Now, if there's a third way to make them, I'm very open to hearing about it, but we've never discovered it.
One other idea that you and others have found is that uncertainty can amplify the emotional potency of events, that happy surprises and unhappy surprises make a bigger impact on us than happy things that we know are going to happen and sad things that we know are going to happen. Why is this and how can we learn from it?
Well, there's no doubt that uncertainty can amplify emotions. So if I tell you something bad is about to happen, it's probably not going to be quite as bad as if it happens by surprise. And the same is true of good events. We've known that for decades, if not centuries, and that's not a particularly deep observation. What we found really interesting is that even though this is true, people never want uncertainty. They eschew it. They pay good money not to have it. We did a study in which people watched a movie, and for some of the people in our experiment, we didn't let them watch how the movie ended. We didn't let them see what happened to the main character. Now, if I asked you which of these two movies would you rather see, 100% of the hands go up and say, I'd like to see the end of the movie, please. But what we discovered was people who didn't see the end of the movie liked it more, thought about it for longer, were still engaged in it and still enjoying it, even hours or days later. They didn't see what happened to the main character in the end, and so they kept wondering, gosh, I wonder if he went to college or he became a football player. What an interesting thing to be thinking about and enjoying. So the point is that a little bit of uncertainty can make you very happy, but we never seem to want it. If flowers showed up on your doorstep tomorrow with no note, just said secret admirer, I bet you'd pay me a lot to find out who the secret admirer was, but I guarantee you, no matter who it is, it's better off just having a secret admirer than knowing who sent the flowers.
Do you actually try and actively build mystery into your own life when it comes to positive events?
I'm not telling.
Dan, I want to thank you for talking with me today. This has really been fun.
Sure, been fun for me too. Thank you.
This episode was produced by Raina Cohen, Parth Shah, and Max Nestrak. It was edited by Tara Boyle and Jenny Schmidt. Our team includes Laura Quirrell and Thomas Liu. I'm Shankar Vedantam. See you next week.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from the George and Faye Young Foundation. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story, and favorite NPR shows become exclusive wines, like the Up First Pinot Grigio, available to adults 21 years or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.